From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll recap what happened yesterday during the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha. Then, in honor of Veterans Day, we'll learn why there are so many World War II-era planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan, and explore a new exhibit that features souvenirs, photos, and trinkets brought home by Wisconsin veterans.
For the last 160 years since the Civil War, Wisconsin service members have been collecting souvenirs and bringing them home. So we want to see that commonality, that human experience. I always tell people it's the humanity behind the history that makes the difference.
Plus, we'll learn about a program aimed at making home buying in Milwaukee simpler for all.
Our agencies have bilingual, multilingual staff members that can help people who have questions, who have doubts because of the language barrier.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. It was a whirlwind day of testimony and arguments yesterday in the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha. The 18-year-old shot three people, killing two of them during the unrest last year that followed the police shooting of Jacob Blake Jr. The events yesterday included the defendant taking the stand, crying during both direct and cross-examination, the judge admonishing the prosecutor several times, and a defense motion for a mistrial. Ultimately, the prosecution continued and finished its cross-examination of Rittenhouse. WUWM's Mayan Silver has been covering the trial, and she's here now with a recap. Mayan, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Joy.
Rittenhouse took the stand Wednesday. How did that play out in court?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. Rittenhouse had been sitting quietly in court for the past 8 days of testimony, occasionally taking notes or yawning, quiet with a guarded expression. Sometimes he would have a hint of a smile during what was presumably helpful testimony, or he'd look away at times during particularly graphic testimony, like when prosecutors showed video of Joseph Rosenbaum, the first man that Rittenhouse shot, taking his last breaths lying on the ground. But Wednesday was really the first time jurors got a chance to hear directly from Rittenhouse, to sort of peel back the armor, if you will. And he was on the stand most of the day. He started out testifying very methodically, presumably having been coached by the defense team. But one point at direct, he got really emotional when he described what he says was Rosenbaum chasing after him.
All right, so let's hear a bit of that testimony.
Once I take that step back, I look over my shoulder and Mr. Rosenbaum was now running from my right side. And I was cornered from in front of me with Mr. Zeminski. And there were there were three people right there.
Take a deep breath, Kyle.
So yeah, we can hear Rittenhouse is breaking down there. What was the response like in court?
The judge immediately called a recess. He said it was time for a break anyway. The in-court pool reporter, who was taking notes for the rest of the media, noted that as the jury was leaving the courtroom, many jurors looked at Rittenhouse in apparent sympathy as he continued to cry, and that his mother, Wendy Rittenhouse, was in the courtroom sobbing as well within earshot of jurors.
So what did Rittenhouse say when he got back on the stand for direct examination by the defense?
So just to frame the testimony, the big issues in this case are for each separate shooting. Did Rittenhouse believe he was going to be assaulted? Was deadly force necessary to stop the assaults? And were those beliefs reasonable? So when Rittenhouse began testifying again, he described what he says was Rosenbaum chasing him into an enclosed area in a car lot. Rittenhouse said that he had no space to run away and that Rosenbaum lunged at him and had his hand on Rittenhouse's gun. Rittenhouse said he feared for his life because he thought Rosenbaum could have gotten the gun and used it against him. Later on in cross-examination, Rittenhouse speculated that Rosenbaum could have used the gun on other people as well that night. Testimony and video have shown that Rosenbaum was unarmed that night and only had a clear plastic bag with some toiletries in it, but apparently Rittenhouse at one point thought he saw him with a chain.
So there's been a lot of talk about whether or not Rittenhouse was fearful when he started shooting, whether or not he was fearful that night. Why are his emotions important to this case?
So it's less about his emotions and more about whether he believed he was under attack. That's one component of a self-defense claim, along with the idea that the amount of force, in this case deadly force, was necessary to stop the attack. So the jury will be deciding that, as well as whether those beliefs were objectively reasonable.
So has there been any evidence presented in court that Rosenbaum was trying to take Rittenhouse's gun?
That's a point of contention in this trial and something that the jury is going to have to resolve. Earlier this week, the prosecution had called forensic pathologist Dr. Doug Kelly to the stand. He testified that Rosenbaum was shot four times and that the first shot was in his groin. The prosecution has attempted to argue that Rosenbaum could have been falling forward from that shot and not lunging at Rittenhouse, or further, that Rosenbaum could have been swatting the gun away instead of grabbing for it, because arguably Rittenhouse was pointing the gun at him, and that Rittenhouse's fear of Rosenbaum grabbing the gun from him was unreasonable.
Has there been any other evidence that would speak to Rittenhouse's fear of Rosenbaum?
So video does show Rosenbaum chasing Rittenhouse into that car lot. The prosecution has shown a lot of drone video and bystander video. Other witnesses have testified that Rosenbaum was being confrontational that night, arguing with people and doing things like throwing rocks, starting fires. Rittenhouse and another armed civilian, Ryan Balsh, says Rosenbaum threatened the two of them that night and said, "If I catch any of you guys alone, I'm going to effing kill you." But actually, another armed civilian witness, Jason Lukowski, called Rosenbaum a, quote, babbling idiot who he wouldn't really be taking seriously. Rittenhouse ultimately says that Rosenbaum threatened him twice and also chased him.
So what did Rittenhouse say about the moments after he shot Rosenbaum?
Rittenhouse says he stopped for a moment and then called his friend who was on the scene to tell him that he just shot somebody because he had to. That friend also testified to that. Rittenhouse said he was going to run up Sheridan Boulevard, the main street where a lot of this unrest was happening, and head to police, but that the crowd started yelling things like, get him," and other things, and he started being chased, essentially.
So that leads to Rittenhouse's confrontation with the second and third men who he shot that night, Anthony Huber and Gage Grosskreutz. So what did he say about that?
Those additional shootings happened moments later, and they're captured on video that was played numerous times in the state's case. It really all happens within seconds, but Anthony Huber hits Rittenhouse with a skateboard. An unidentified man the defense calls Jump Kick Man comes in and kicks Rittenhouse, who, because of these things, falls down.
We're going to play a clip of defense attorney Mark Richards asking Rittenhouse to describe the moments before he shoots Anthony Huber, who he killed, and then Gage Grosskreutz, who survived.
As a result of being kicked in the face, what happens?
Mr. Huber, immediately after I'm kicked in the face, runs up as I'm sitting up to try to get up and get to the police. I'm on my back, and Mr. Huber runs up. As I'm getting up, he strikes me in the neck with his skateboard a second time.
Then what happens?
He grabs my gun, and I can feel it pulling away from me, and I can feel the strap starting to come off my body.
And what do you do then?
I fire one shot.
And after you fire, striking, we now know, Mr. Huber, what do you do?
I lower my weapon, and I see Mr. Grosskreutz with his hands up, and as I'm lowering my weapon, I look down, and then Mr. Grosskreutz, he lunges at me with his pistol pointed directly at my head.
Gage Grosskreutz also testified in this trial Monday, and he said that right before his hand was pointed down in the direction of Rittenhouse, he had raised his hands in surrender, and that he had interpreted Rittenhouse's re-racking his gun or putting another bullet in the chamber. That's what he says he was able to tell. Rittenhouse testified yesterday that he didn't do that. Some additional defense witnesses are likely to speak on that.
So the prosecution got a chance to cross-examine Rittenhouse. What were the key takeaways from that?
At first, the prosecution focused on Rittenhouse's decisions to possess an AR-15 underage and go to the unrest in Kenosha, after a curfew, and didn't really focus on the shooting events themselves. There was a lot of discussion of what Rittenhouse did or didn't do on the streets of Kenosha. There were some cross-examination tactics that got Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger into a lot of heat with the court, and which resulted in a motion for mistrial from the defense. But later in the day, Binger started focusing on the minutes and moments leading up to the Rittenhouse shooting of Rosenbaum and then Huber and Grosskreutz. And Rittenhouse really stuck to his playbook, saying that he thought his life was under threat and didn't want to kill anyone that night, just save himself. Binger did get Rittenhouse to admit that the whole night no one fired any shots at him, but Rittenhouse was steadfast in his message that he thought his life was under threat and that he thought both Rosenbaum and Huber could take his gun and that Grosskreutz's gun was pointed at his head. Here's an example of Binger trying to get Rittenhouse to stray from that narrative.
Frame 500 shows you firing your AR-15 towards Gage Grosskreutz. At this particular moment, he does not have that pistol pointed towards you, does he?
He does.
His left leg has stepped across not directly towards you, but to the side of you, correct?
Yes.
He's reaching in with his left arm towards you, correct?
Yes.
He never steps back and puts the gun in both hands in a ready aim position towards you, does he?
He doesn't do that.
He never takes that gun with his right hand and stands there and holds it out with his right hand in front of him and aims it directly at you, does he?
No, he does this, pointing it directly at my head.
And you thought that's the way he was going to shoot you?
Yeah.
So in addition to Rittenhouse's testimony, there was just a lot of arguing yesterday. The judge admonished the prosecution several times during cross-examination, and the defense moved for a mistrial. Can you explain what that was about?
Right. So the defense moved for a mistrial with prejudice, meaning that Rittenhouse couldn't be tried again, saying that the state had disregarded court's orders in bad faith and that the state was essentially throwing the trial. The defense was seizing on the judge's anger at the prosecution for its tactics and for what the court said was disregarding the court's prior rulings and the defendant's right to pretrial silence.
Here is Judge Bruce Schrader addressing that.
Why would you think that that made it okay for you, without any advance notice, to bring this matter before the jury? I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that.
What did the prosecution do that led to this exchange?
So on cross-examination, Assistant District Attorney Binger questioned Rittenhouse about why he was just now telling his story after dozens of witnesses had testified, implying there was something deceptive or manipulative about that. And the judge immediately halted the proceedings, sent the jury out of the room, and lashed out at Binger for violating Rittenhouse's Fifth Amendment right to pretrial silence. So defendants don't have to give statements to the police. They don't even have to testify. And those facts can't be used against them in court. The prosecution later said that Rittenhouse possibly waived his right by talking to the media, but that wasn't really established, and it seems Binger just dropped that line of questioning. The prosecution also came under fire from the judge for trying to impeach Rittenhouse on statements and photos before and after the shootings, specifically a statement from Rittenhouse weeks or months before in which he had allegedly said that he wished he had his gun so that he could shoot suspected shoplifters. The judge had previously closed the door on that questioning, but Binger thought something Rittenhouse said in his testimony possibly opened up the door and that it had never been totally closed. That got the judge upset.
There was, you know, don't get into other subjects. Come on, what you're telling me, you're an experienced trial attorney, and you're telling me that when the judge says, I'm excluding this, you just to take it upon yourself to put it in because you think that you've found a way around it? Come on.
The prosecution also wanted to refer to a selfie Rittenhouse took after the events while on bond with a shirt that said, free as a four-letter word starting with an F. The judge didn't let him, saying that it would only be relevant if Rittenhouse was on trial for bad judgment.
What happened to the motion for a mistrial?
So the prosecutor said he was acting in good faith, but the judge said he didn't believe him.
I don't believe you. There better not be another incident. I'll take the motion under advisement.
Ultimately, Schrader let the testimony continue.
All around, a pretty contentious day. What's next for this trial?
So we got a little taste of that after the jury was excused for the day. Richards, the defense attorney, said the defense will be calling three more witnesses. Once the defense rests, there could be rebuttal witnesses from the state and eventually jury instructions and closing arguments. Judge Schrader told the jury the trial might be wrapping up on Tuesday.
And I'm sure you will be there following it. Mayan, as always, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Joy.
Mayan Silver is a WUWM news reporter who's been covering the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha. You can find more of our coverage of the trial at WUWM.com. Coming up, in honor of Veterans Day, we'll look at a new exhibit that explores the souvenirs, trinkets, and photographs brought home by Wisconsin veterans. But first, we'll learn why there are so many World War II-era planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In honor of Veterans Day, Lake Effect is exploring Milwaukee's history of service and contributions to our nation's wars. Although Lake Michigan is more well known for its shipping history, it's also been a vital resource for U.S. war efforts. Scouring the bottom of the lake will not only lead you to its many shipwrecks, but a large number of World War II-era planes. So, how did they get there? Ben Page is the Museum Collections Curator at the EAA Aviation Museum in Oshkosh, and he explains more.
There was a tremendous amount of training going on during the Second World War right in Lake Michigan. The Navy, pretty quickly after Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, recognized that they were going to need to train a lot of aviators, and just as importantly, teach them how to take off and land from a moving ship, an aircraft carrier. There were great fears. There were very few aircraft carriers available to the Navy immediately after Pearl Harbor. And there was also a fear that there would be enemy submarines on both the Atlantic and the Pacific. So the fear of risking one of these ships and also keeping it away from the front lines led the Navy to purchase two paddle wheel excursion liners. These are ships that would run between the big cities mainly between Lake Michigan and Lake Erie, Detroit, Cleveland, and Buffalo. They took all the cabins out, scrapped them all the way down to the tops of their hulls, put flight decks on top of them, and turned them into really the world's only, to date, coal-powered, paddle-wheel, freshwater aircraft carriers. And they were used between 1942 all the way to the end of the war as that final step of training for both Naval and Marine Corps aviators before they would go out to sea combat.
So what made Lake Michigan specifically a good place for this kind of training?
Well, it was really Chicago. There was at that time a sizable naval presence at Naval Air Station Glenview. This is today most widely known as a suburb just to the north of Chicago. Very large naval base there, which is where the aircraft would actually be based. The Navy had training facilities at what we now know today as Navy Pier right there on Lake Michigan, right in downtown Chicago. So really, it was that location. The aircraft could operate out of Glenview and the ships could operate right out of Chicago. They'd kind of meet in the middle of the lake, and that's where they would go train.
So it was a relatively short period of time where they were using the lake. How many pilots were actually trained on Lake Michigan?
Well, between the two ships, when the weather was cooperating, the ships were slower than any of the big carriers. So if the wind wasn't cooperating, they would actually have to shut down flight operations for that day. You could get about 100 of these guys getting their minimum of 8 takeoffs and 8 landings per day. But over the course of the war, that equates to over 15,000 Navy and Marine Corps pilots who completed their carrier qualification right in Lake Michigan.
Over that time, there were 15,000 pilots trained. You have to imagine there were a lot of, you know, training sessions on the lake. How many planes actually crashed?
Well, the numbers go anywhere between 150 to as many as 300. Have to remember that these were pilots who had just come out of flight training. And just as importantly, they had to qualify in the aircraft, the same type of aircraft they had to take into combat. This could be a fighter airplane, a dive bomber, a torpedo bomber. And landing any aircraft like that on even a full-size carrier is a unique challenge in naval aviation. But you have to remember these ships were smaller, they were slower, and they were still kind of learning the ropes, as it were. So it's not terribly surprising that a few of them did go over the side and end up on the bottom of the lake.
Sure. So now, how many planes remain at the bottom of Lake Michigan?
Well, to date, I personally know of 50 aircraft. They've all, for the most part, been recovered by a Chicago-based company, A&T Recovery. And the vast majority of those aircraft have ended up in museums, a lot like ours. So there could still be anywhere from 100 to 200 aircraft still waiting down there on the bottom.
So you have a plane that has been at the bottom of Lake Michigan. I have to imagine that was a fairly lengthy restoration process. What is it like taking a plane that has been submerged for decades and restoring it?
I do want to be clear. We did not restore this particular machine. It was one of the first to come out of the lake in the early 90s when they started pulling these out. But I can say one of my previous postings, I was lucky enough to actually see one of these aircraft as soon as it came out of the water, more or less. It really depends how hard the aircraft hit. But in general, you got to remember, this is a freshwater lake. It's pretty deep out there in the middle of the lake where these guys would train and where most of these aircraft went down. The Navy does a very good job, as you can probably imagine, rust-proofing their aircraft so that they can stand up to conditions at sea. So generally, when these aircraft come out of the water, you can still see fresh paint. You can still identify markings. The cockpits are invariably open. So generally, there's a lot of silt in the bottom. But really, because of those conditions in the lake, being cold, deep, and fresh water, they come out not looking too terribly worse for wear.
What can we learn from these planes?
Well, definitely the historical side of things. The reason a lot of these aircraft were being recovered in the 90s was at the behest of the museum in Pensacola, the National Naval Aviation Museum. Naval aircraft, especially of that vintage, are not as common. They weren't produced in as large numbers as their Army Air Force counterparts. Not as many were saved for preservation. And there's all different types down there. If it flew off a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier during World War II, chances are an example ended up on the bottom of Lake Michigan between 1942 and 1945. in a lot of cases, these are the sole surviving examples of those types anywhere in the world. So I think definitely it's sort of an accidental, if you will, method by which these aircraft were saved and preserved on the bottom and then brought to the surface and restored for future generations to see the types of machines that these young men took into combat, but also a little bit of that local history and what the greater Lake Michigan area, one of these roles that this part of the country played during World War II. It's a very unique story, very unique to the United States, I would say, and a very significant contribution, I would say, to the ultimate victory by carrier air power.
For sure. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
Ben Page is the Museum Collections Curator at the EAA Aviation Museum in Oshkosh. And he spoke with me about the history of World War II naval planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Right now at the museum, you can see a classic Grumman F4-F3 Wildcat fighter that was salvaged and restored after crashing into Lake Michigan in the 1940s. All veterans carry with them a part of the war in which they served. Many of these things are intangible lessons and memories made during their time at war. Others are souvenirs, trinkets, or photographs from their travels that give some insight into a service member's experiences outside of combat. The Wisconsin Veterans Museum's new exhibit called Souvenirs of Service explores the history of things brought back by Wisconsin veterans. Kevin Hampton is the curator of history for the museum, and he joins me now to talk about the exhibit. Kevin, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
When we think about war souvenirs, I think a lot of things can come to mind. Just in general, what's the nature of these souvenirs? Some of them almost seem like the same kinds of things that you'd get as a tourist.
That's exactly right. I think souvenir, in its basic sense, is something that we all can relate to. You know, we've all been walking past the gift shop, you know, on the street or in the airport and seen the snow globes and postcards and trinkets, the baubles, if you will. And what we're doing with this exhibit, we're really trying to look at souvenirs, not just as a token of, you know, proving I was there. Really, we're looking at what's the heart of each souvenir. And in some cases, the ones that are going to be highlighted in the center, in the heart of the exhibit, are the ones that you wouldn't expect. It's the thing that you're looking at it and you really can't actually tell why somebody would keep this without knowing the story. Because as we say at the Veterans Museum, every veteran is a story. And it is something that I truly believe in, where it's the story that makes the difference. A lot of times history is considered a what, you know, the question of what happened, you know, what happened there or what happened here or when for that matter. But really, in my opinion, the ultimate question of history is why? Why did this happen? And in this case, why did the service member bring home this piece? Why did they keep this piece? Why was it such a treasured piece?
Thinking about these kinds of souvenirs and where they come from, it's a reminder that most soldiers are young men who are frequently leaving the country for the first time, going abroad. How do we see these travels and these experiences revealed through their souvenirs?
That's an excellent observation. I would posit, though, as well, that you can also get a souvenir stateside. One of the most iconic pieces that you will see actually from the Spanish-American War all the way through to pretty much Vietnam, if not a little bit later into the 80s, are pillow shams. And these pillow shams were really, you know, this trend, almost like, you know, the thimble or the spoon. You picked one up and you sent it home to mom kind of thing. And each one is uniquely tailored to the location that you picked it up or the messaging that's on it. You know, a lot of sweetheart pillow shams from World War II, a lot of dear mother pillow shams. So it's kind of neat to see the difference of the type of souvenir that people pick up stateside versus the type of souvenir that people pick up overseas. But in the way the exhibit is laid out, I've laid it out chronologically. So it's a single gallery. And then the gallery on the outside of the walls, we follow the timeline because it's a common human impulse across time. For the last 160 years since the Civil War, Wisconsin service members have been collecting souvenirs and bringing them home. So we want to see that commonality, that human experience. I always tell people it's the humanity behind the history that makes the difference. It's the faces behind the facts that really makes it relatable. And so if you're looking at this timeline of what types of stuff was brought back, what types of stuff was collected on the outside of the wall, you're going to see actually some fairly similar patterns. You know, from the photograph of the soldiers in the Philippines in 1900 during the Spanish-American War, just shortly thereafter, riding the water buffalo because it's, you know, their first time in an exotic place for them, you know, that's not Wisconsin, to the person riding the camel in Kuwait in 1991. And you're seeing these commonalities. You know, you've got the generation that takes their photo in front of the Eiffel Tower at the end of the Great War, and then you've got the ones that do the same thing in 1946. And you can start seeing that connection between generations and hopefully understand history and military service as not isolated chapters, but as a continuum of human experience. And you start looking at it generationally and how, you know, the next generation kind of does the same thing the last generation did.
You mentioned, of course, the pillow shams as being an item that appear for a long time. Are there other continuing souvenirs that we see that come up through the generations?
That's a good question. I would say probably photographs are the one thing that unite all the eras. That and probably patches, unit patches, you know, especially with Civil War, where photography is such a new thing. It's almost an impulse to collect the photos of yourself and send them home, but also the photos of your comrades. One of the stories that we'll start with, you'll see in the Civil War selection of over 192 photographs that one of the soldiers from Wisconsin, Peter Arndt, collected of famous generals and politicians and people in history, because that was how he commemorated his time. He also collected photographs of the opponents. He collected Confederate generals and politicians. That is the big commonality, though, is the pictures, because from there, you move into ways to document where you've been. And you've got, of course, the soldier standing in front of the Leaning Tower of Pisa during World War II, the soldiers or service members, you know, standing on top of the USS Maine wreckage during the Spanish-American War, all the way through to today, where, you know, you could ask the question, has the selfie replaced the souvenir in many ways? You know, in an era of social media and digital assets and digital engagement, we tend to treat our social media platform as ways of documenting our experiences.
Sure. Do you have examples from soldiers who are more recent?
Oh, yes. Yep. We go all the way through current day. We start the story on the outside exterior of the gallery in 1860, and we go up by 20-year increments. And it ends with the ultimate question, what's the story of your souvenirs?
Now, as we look at this exhibit, I know that there are a number of Milwaukee veterans who are represented. What are some of those stories that stand out to you?
For Milwaukee in particular, there's several really good ones. Of course, probably quite a few will have heard of Charles King of the King family of Wisconsin. Of course, the namesake of King, Wisconsin now, the town in central Wisconsin. But Charles King, the King family, originates out of Milwaukee. And one of his pieces, he's actually credited with the longest military service of any individual in the United States in the Army, because he actually serves as an aide to his father, Rufus King, during the Civil War. And he actually serves then all the way through actually World War I. And so he's got the longest period of service than any other soldier in the United States history. But the piece that we're highlighting is actually a pair of buckskin trousers that Charles King received as a gift from Buffalo Bill during what they call the Great Sioux War of 1876, when he was serving with the 5th U.S. Cavalry. And he's got a great story because he befriended Buffalo Bill during his time in service earlier that decade and just after the Civil War. And actually, he describes it in the letter of why he got it and how he got it. Another great one from Milwaukee, and perhaps a lesser known name, is actually going to be one of the more iconic pieces, I think, if you're thinking about a souvenir. And that's going to be the small Eiffel Tower statue and clogs from Holland collected by Chester Budish, who was originally from Ohio, but then afterwards settled in Milwaukee. He's got a great story about these souvenirs because of how he procured them. He's serving with the 62nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion in World War II, and he's fighting in Holland in the fall of 1944. And he was looking for a pair of wooden shoes to send home. So this is a great example of a soldier with already that predetermined in mind. These are the souvenirs. This is the iconic thing that I need to collect and bring home. And it happened to be that there was somebody just going by next to him on a bicycle with a pair of clogs on. And he happened to stop him and said, you know, hey, you know, could I trade you for it? And he ends up getting these clogs literally right off the feet of this bicyclist directly from his feet and sends them home, mails them home as the souvenir. And then the Eiffel Tower has a great story, the little statue of the Eiffel Tower. He was actually wounded by friendly fire in Belgium in November of 44 and was transferred to a hospital in France. And as he was being transported through Paris, he was actually in an overcrowded ambulance. So the ambulance doors had to be open to fit everybody in. And as he's waiting in traffic, and it's literally in Paris, a Parisian traffic, they're stuck in traffic, all these wounded soldiers on this ambulance. He sees out the back open doors of this ambulance, this vendor on the street, and asks the driver to get out because they're not going anywhere. Traffic isn't moving. But he asked the driver to get out of the vehicle and to buy the Eiffel Tower statue for him so he could bring it home. And he gives him some money to do so. So it's really those kinds of stories that hopefully are going to illustrate what we're trying to show, which is it's the story behind it. Because, you know, if you came across this little Eiffel Tower statue, that great, you know, obviously he'd been to Paris clearly because he'd served in France and, you know, it might be just a generic souvenir. But the fact that we know exactly how he procured it and why gives it so much more meaning and depth.
Sure. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Kevin Hampton is the curator of history at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He spoke with me about the museum's current exhibit called Souvenirs of Service, The Things They Kept. The exhibit will be open for the next 2 years, with plans to showcase new souvenirs throughout its run. Coming up, we'll tell you about Take Root Milwaukee and their mission to make home buying accessible to all members of our community. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Buying your first home can be overwhelming. There's legal jargon, piles of paperwork, and hoops to jump through when you're applying for a loan. It's even harder when English isn't your first language. Take Root Milwaukee wants to help bridge that gap. The organization provides multilingual resources and goes step-by-step with community members wanting to buy their first homes. Joanna Jimenez is a program manager at Take Root Milwaukee under the Urban Economic Development Association of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Take Root Milwaukee is a consortium of different organizations, city government, real estate professionals, community organizations, lenders, and realtors that all come together to provide and promote reliable resources for people who want to become homeowners or current homeowners who may need assistance to be able to keep their home, and also resources to help those homeowners who may need repairs done to their property.
In the state of Wisconsin specifically, there's a wide home ownership gap. The Center for Responsible Lending found that just to have enough money to save up for the 5% mortgage down payment and closing costs, it would take approximately 14 years for a Black household at the national median income level to save up for that, and 11 years for a Latino family. In comparison, a white family needs about 9 years. So what is the importance of building and facilitating workshops for non-native English speakers specifically looking to buy their first homes?
Communities of color don't always have access to the education, to the support, to the resources that can help them become financially stable to be able to make their homeownership dreams come true. I came on board about 2 years ago, and I am a bilingual. Spanish is my first native language. And so I've been using this platform to reach out to my own community and other communities that are not native English speakers to let them know that there are resources available. A lot of our agencies have bilingual, multilingual staff members that can help people who have questions, who have doubts. You know, because of the language barrier, there seems to be a little bit of a trust issue. It is important for us to be able to get the word across that there are resources, you know, that someone can pay a down payment of less than 5%, like you mentioned, but FHA is a perfect example. That's a 3% down payment. But the programs that some of our agencies have are able to help, you know, new homeowners find other resources to be able to buy a home. For example, a down payment assistance grant. The city of Milwaukee just launched one. So, you know, we are constantly putting the word out there to all communities that homeownership is affordable and definitely possible for anyone.
I'm really interested to hear about the types of specific challenges that you hear from non-native English speakers, you hear from other members within our communities of color, and you use the word trust issues. What do you mean by that? What have you heard?
You know, being from another country, you know, our culture is very important to us, right? Our language is very important to us. The way we have relationships with people, whether it's our, you know, personal relationships or professional relationships. So being able to be in the community with the people who are experiencing disparities and being able to communicate my own personal story. And I know many of our members have personal stories as well that could be empowering to someone else. You know, I'm a first generation homeowner in my family. And so that means a lot, you know, to my family. And if I can, you know, be an example for the other generations that coming behind me, right? My children, my great grandchildren, to be able to reach out to someone who you have something in common helps with those trust issues, helps to build relationship and trust. So that's what I mean about, you know, trust issues. Sometimes it's easier to speak to someone about hard things like banking in your own language.
Yeah, even in other languages, describing and explaining banking and buying a home, it doesn't make sense with all the legal jargon, in my opinion.
No, absolutely. That's something I struggled with. And so I came here to the United States when I was very young, and I had to learn English right away because my parents didn't know. So I had to help them, right? So being in school, I was able to learn English. But when I became a licensed real estate agent, I didn't know technical terms in Spanish, professional terms of a house, a mortgage, a down payment assistance, you know, so I had to educate myself, you know, and I was feeling like I was sounding like an alien, right? Like I'm speaking alien, foreign, out of space type of language, you know, when I was trying to talk to my clients. And so I had to educate myself again so that I can come across as clear and as accurate and definitely trustworthy.
I'm just wondering now too, what are some of the misconceptions and myths and just not correct or not right information that you hear from folks buying a home for the first time?
So some of the things that I can think of that may be misconceptions or myths. Number one is that homeownership isn't affordable for everyone. I think that, you know, if you work really hard at your finances, at savings, if you're frugal, if you're just knowledgeable about what resources are out here, definitely people will see that it's possible. Another thing is that with the way that the rental market is nowadays in the Milwaukee area market, it is cheaper to buy a home and maintain a home than it is to rent, just because the rent is just really, really high, right? And so a lot of people are recognizing that. And so that's what I would say, that sometimes in some markets, and you know, with everything lined up perfectly, right, it could be cheaper to own a home than to actually continue to rent. I think another one is that you need a lot of money to be able to buy a home. Like I said, there are many grants available, a lot of programs, both government and private, that will help people, you know, come up with that down payment assistance to be able to buy a home. There's even employer assisted programs to help people buy homes in specific neighborhoods.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that. Could you go into more detail about that? How can people look to see if they qualify for that?
Sure. I mean, I would tell people to first ask their employer. If they're a major employer, most of the time they have employee assistance programs, and one of those could be a home ownership or a rent and incentive program. So I can give you an example. The Near West Side Partners organization is made up of 7 different neighborhoods, and they all have or anchor stakeholders such as Harley-Davidson, Pottawatomie. Those big employers want to attract people to their neighborhood, and why not, you know, help an employee of theirs to live close to where they work. They have this program. They provide incentives for people to rent in the neighborhood that they work in and to also buy a home. So each program may be different about the amounts, depending on the availability of funds. Another example is the Haven Woods neighborhood. They have a very strong business presence in that area. And so some of those employers are helping people also buy homes within, you know, the vicinity of where their employment is. You'll never know what resources are out there, you know, if one, you don't ask or you don't research. So we do the research, and it's all on our website. And the more information we can get out there, the better.
And what resources are available online, and are they available in multiple languages?
Yes. So pre-COVID, you know, we used to have in-person events. We used to have homeownership fairs where our members would come table and bring all their information. Again, we have lenders, we have real estate, we have the city government agencies, and we have community organizations that all offer resources. And so the public was able to come. We would host webinars on different topics. Some of those topics were credit, repair, savings, the home buying process. And then we would actually even have a bus tour to show people, you know, this is a house and this is how much it would cost you to pay a mortgage in it. And so, and what we wanted to do is to be in as many neighborhoods as possible. So we would do the homeownership fairs in conjunction with different neighborhoods. And some of those neighborhoods have a higher population of a non, you know, native English speaking demographic. So an example is when we did one at Bradley Tech High School, a lot of the population in that area is Spanish speaking. So we actually provided headsets for that program that talked about, you know, home ownership from beginning to end. So another thing, you know, with COVID and the pandemic, we've had to kind of pivot, you know, the way we get our message across. And so we're using social media and technology. And so we started to record our webinars to be able to have it live in our YouTube channel, and, you know, people can have access to it. Whenever we put out, you know, any kind of material that speaks about foreclosure prevention, again, the resources due to COVID-19 that homeowners needed, we try to get it out there in as many languages as possible. We're always looking to partner with other organizations who primarily help people of other native languages. So again, you know, Take Root Milwaukee wants to be diverse and wants to be able to reach as many people as possible.
Joanna Jimenez is a program manager at Take Root Milwaukee under the Urban Economic Development Association of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in August. You can learn more about Take Root's home ownership resources at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Beck Salgado, Chase Browning, and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our audio engineer, Michelle Matanowski is our digital manager, and Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon, when we'll unpack the generational impact of Native American boarding schools and why the federal government is investigating them. Plus, we'll talk to a wildlife specialist about how tribes plan to coexist with the wolf now that they've been delisted. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at wuwm.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. And thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.